Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. On a recent show, we discussed the rising number of scams where someone contacts you by email or phone and tries to get you to send them money. People actually lose billions of dollars through these scams by strangers. But people lose even more money to people they know. Today, we'll discuss financial exploitation by family and friends and how you can protect yourself from it. Our guest today is Judith Kozlowski, a fraud expert with the Department of Justice, Elder Justice Initiative. She's also a senior fellow at WISER, the Women's Institute for a Secure Retirement. Prior to that, she was senior advisor at Health and Human Services, where she developed a national policy to prevent elder abuse and financial exploitation. She served as a state and federal prosecutor in New York, Miami, and Washington, D.C., where she focused on fraud and white-collar crime. As an assistant U.S. attorney, she created and ran an elder financial exploitation federal prosecution team. She was also a trial counsel and branch chief at the Security and Exchange Commission, and director of the Criminal Prosecution Assistance Group at the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. Ms. Kozlowski helped establish the Office for the Financial Protection of Older Americans at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She speaks often about elder justice, particularly financial exploitation, and she is a friend of mine. Judith Kozlowski, welcome back to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. I think the most important piece is that I am a friend of yours. I think that's that's always the most important thing. So, this afternoon we're going to talk about a subject that is near and dear to my heart, because I do so much work in the area of financial exploitation of older adults. But I want to just caution that what I'm saying today really has applicability across the lifespan. This isn't just about older people, although we find more frequently that the financial exploitation occurs with older adults because, as you know, a famous robber said, that's where the money is.
Right.
Older adults have had a lifetime to accumulate wealth, and often there are other family members and friends and trusted parties who are all too eager to take that. And often when I'm talking about this topic, because family is usually the group that takes money from older adults, I think that we call that a little bit of inheritance impatience. And I think we should always hold that in mind. There's often the discussion by someone who's taken a lot of money from someone, a family member, that, well, I was going to get it anyway. And that really doesn't make it right, as we all know. And maybe that's what you thought you were going to get it, but maybe that was not the intent of that older person.
Right.
I just want to back up for a second, though, and I want to, point out something Eleanor did earlier, which is the fact that elder financial exploitation is an international problem. The things that we're talking about today are going to be similar to what happens in many other countries, as well as the United States. And the amount of money that is taken from older adults, particularly, is in the billions. Because we have so little data, it's somewhere between $2 billion and $36 or $37 billion a year.
And that's just exploitation of the elders.
That's exploitation of the elders.
But the rest of everybody else is getting scammed every day, too.
That's right. Mm. And of that number, easily, 60% of that is usually friends, is usually family. And another 20% of that number is generally a trusted other, someone who is a participant in that older adult's life and gets to befriend them in some form or fashion or perform some service for them. And, some of the categories aren't just the inheritance impatience that's exhibited by children and nieces, nephews, and grandchildren. And I must say, I looked at this list and realized I have prosecuted people in every one of these categories. Sorry to say, one of the bigger cases I did was something I called the case of the nefarious nephew. This is someone who showed up kind of out of nowhere and then proceeded to take hundreds of thousands of dollars from his uncle, Russell. And later, after he finished his term of incarceration, came back on the scene. And
he was caught and he was prosecuted.
Oh, he's caught. He was prosecuted. He was convicted.
Did the uncle get the money back?
No, because it had been spent on intangibles. Mm-hmm. That we couldn't. We got some of it back. Like, we returned his house to him, which had been taken from him. There was a piece of land, and that was also taken in Virginia. That had been in the family for generations. That had been taken from him. Mm-hmm. There were other things, but to make him whole, no, we were not quite able to do that. But this was a good example of sometimes what can happen in families. Someone heard Uncle Russell was sad because his wife had died, and he and his wife worked at the Department of Bureau Engraving. He was a GS-4. She was a GS-3. They saved enough money to buy a home in Washington, D.C., and live there. And when, after his wife died, the nephew heard that he wasn't doing so well, you know, because he was sad, not because he wasn't physically able to do things. So he moved in with his wife and two children, and then proceeded to become closer to Uncle Russell, who didn't really like him very much in the first place, but he began to forge documents in Uncle Russell's name. He forged a power of attorney, which was given to him, and then proceeded to empty his bank accounts, to take the real estate from him, to buy all sorts of extravagant items.
Holy cow, that seems pretty, really nasty.
And it's awful.
But that's not a common kind of fraud, right? That is that kind of unusual?
That is a pretty common kind of fraud.
Really?
You know, it's not so uncommon. Somebody here is an older solo person in their family needs some mm-hmm. comfort, and they're willing to move in. And the thing is, he took some of the money, and this was one of my favorite things to say to the jury. He formed a company called Living Large.
And I thought, Large?
Living Large.
Oh, Living Large. Your uncle.
And I said, yes, on Uncle Russell's money. So that was another example was.
Well, wait, how much time did this nephew end up spending in jail?
I think about 6 years, which
Fantastic.
Was a large, it's a big sentence for something like that.
What an absolute creep.
Oh, I can't even describe it. I was later called by a reporter who found him doing real estate scams in a nearby state using some of the same techniques. So the jail sentence didn't seem to temper his enthusiasm for entrepreneurship, if you will. You know. Anyway.
Oh my God, that's up.
But he started off with the money from Uncle Russell. Another example is grandchildren who often know a grandparent or a beloved aunt or uncle or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this was a plain case of going to the bank with grandma in this case, and she requests the bank teller to give her $15,000 and make it out to her grandson who is next to her. The bank teller was alert and said, why does he need $15,000? And she said, oh, it's for his college fees. The teller said, oh, we do this all the time, but we write the check out to the educational institution. We never give it to the person. And it turned out, so they left because the grandson realized he wasn't getting what he wanted. So they came back a couple of days later. She came back with him. And this time he said he wanted the money for a car. So he was ready to steal the money for a false reason, but the grandmother didn't want to buy him a car. So she didn't, and they didn't get the money. So the grandson never got the money, but he tried the second time to explain to the teller that he needed a car to go to school. And the bank teller was smart enough to know that wasn't the case. So they separated the grandson from the grandmother, and she went and talked to the bank supervisor, who uncovered all of this information, and they refused to do the transaction. So she blamed it on the bank, and she felt better, but he never got the money. But it was an it was a good example of sometimes family members may start out with money for college or money for a car, and then may increase their demands as time goes on.
Yeah. So on that instance, say with the grandson and the grandmother, and he's trying to get the money from the grandmother, I would imagine, you know, that tends to be a very close, positive relationship for most people. Even if you don't get along with the parents, you get along with the grandparents.
Right. Exactly.
But she would be trusting him, and then he takes advantage of that trust.
Right.
But how... I would imagine in her mind, she would find it hard to believe that her grandson would try to swindle her out of money.
Yes. But what helped was that she wanted very much to pay for his college because his parents were unable to do so, and she could help. And when they explained, and then they were able to show her other wire transfers that went out to educational institutions and the information that people come in with to do it legitimately, she was convinced that maybe this wasn't right. So she wanted him to go back to his college and give her the information so she could do the right thing at the bank. And he never did that. And that's when he switched to the story about how he needed a car to go to college. And that was less convincing to her. She was ready to pay the tuition and get him into the classroom, but not necessarily to provide transportation.
So did she ever become aware that her grandson was just trying to get money from her?
Yes.
Finally woke up.
Well, because the bank had been trained. The bank teller had been trained to spot this. The bank supervisor had been trained to spot this. And they were prepared with arguments to give her about why this shouldn't be the case. And luckily, she agreed. But they came back a couple times, and he stopped coming with her to the bank. The other thing the bank could do and did in this case was put a flag on her account. Mm-hmm. So if she were to come in again with him or to ask for other large withdrawals, completely uncharacteristic of her normal behavior, they were ready for her. And that went to all the branches of that particular bank, you know, so that it was universal in many ways. But those are two, you know, sort of clear examples of family taking some money and beginning a process of exploitation of an older adult, particularly, but of someone close to them and someone that person trusted and believed in and wanted to help. You know, that's the other aspect of some of this family stuff is initially it starts as a request for money or financial assistance in some way for what sounds like a legitimate purpose. Mm-hmm. And then it builds to a second legitimate purpose and becomes, I mean, at some point it wasn't legitimate to begin with, and it becomes less legitimate as those requests change. So we've seen this over and over again. This also happens with children and particularly there are many examples of caregiver stress where one child is taking care of that older adult and knows and begins to understand what the financial situation is and will ask for money for. It could be a car, it could be clothes, it could be a trip, it could be this, it could be that. It could be access to a debit card, which would then be used, or you know, any kind of debit card that could be used at any a number of branches of a particular bank to withdraw money. This happens with both the child and often caregivers, where it begins with, I'll give you the debit card to buy groceries or to go to the pharmacy for me or to help me with some other kind of, task. And then you pretty soon, if you were to look at the credit card or the debit card statement, you would see that groceries were purchased, you know, multiple times a day. There were also, because there were withdrawals. I had one case where I think it was a son who got access to a a debit card and then used it at multiple branches. So we could trace where he was at different times of day because of the branches that he went to withdraw the money, and was taking out the maximum that he could on a daily basis for months, because he knew when checks were deposited into the account and when the money could be withdrawn.
So this is a caregiver taking care of their parent, who's an elderly yes. parent, and then right. takes advantage of their reliance on them. You know, maybe the parent can't get to the grocery store, or
often not.
Yeah. Now with COVID, you don't want to go right. still. And once they get a hold of the card, they can use it for whatever multiple purposes.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that would happen with caregivers, even if they're strangers, maybe even more likely if you're a senior or you've got some kind of medical situation
right.
where you're dependent on someone to give you care,
right.
that you build up, there's a situation of trust, and then boom, they take right. advantage of it, and maybe just a little bit at the beginning, and they get away with it, and then they keep, it grows. Right.
So at first you go to the grocery store and you bring the groceries back and you see how that goes. And then maybe you go to the grocery store and get $50 back, and then you come home with the groceries. You know, it just becomes something that becomes very easy. Nobody's checking it necessarily. There's and it's not huge amounts of money at the beginning, but over time it can be particularly lucrative, you know, and it doesn't have to be huge amounts of money that we might hear of. In all of these cases, whenever something is taken from an older adult, it's still theft. It's still taking something without permission. It doesn't really matter, in my mind anyway, if it's $10 or $10,000. It's not yours.
Right.
It's not
yours. That's what I went to Catholic school, and the nuns taught us, you know, you take one penny and it's not yours. It's stealing. So make sure it goes back to the person to whom it belongs.
Yes, exactly. So it's sort of the same concept. So I've had cases where lawyers have taken advantage of people by overcharging or double billing in some circumstances, where it builds up a kind of a client relationship, where that also the lawyer may write him or herself into a will or some other testamentary to receive some sort of fee that they're not entitled to, or some kind of something else. We also have I've also had cases where the bankers have set up accounts and diverted funds from one bank account into their own bank account for, quote, safekeeping, whatever that means. And we have found tellers that have done that. I have, you know, whatever. I've also seen accountants who have also filed, billed in ways for services that were not given, and done that on a regular basis. That's exploiting. That's taking money that's not yours to take. I've had many cases, unfortunately, of investment advisors and brokers who have one really heartbreaking case to me. This was an investment advisor at a very famous firm, and had a group of people that he was representing who were all cafeteria workers in a public school system. And they gave him their money to invest. He took their money, changed their account statements to look like they were the old account statements. They were all completely false. He took the money, invested it in his own sort of fake startup companies, in which he ended up getting millions of dollars ultimately from these cafeteria workers who had saved and saved and saved to have the first generation of their family go to college, to do, you know, to think big, improving the economic lot of these particular individuals. And he'd frittered all the money away. It had completely disappeared. I couldn't get any restitution for them except by going back to the big firm where he worked, and having them, provide some compensation to the victims in that particular case. But they all trusted him. They met with him on a regular basis. They had, they had special meetings with him. He would go to the cafeterias and meet with them. It was all a very close personal relationship. And it started out legitimately at first, but then he veered off and started taking their money instead of investing it as he said that he would. I've also had tax preparers. One of my bigger cases was also a tax preparer who was able, he worked at H&R Block for a long, long time. And then he went off, took some of those clients with him to his own newly established solo practice. Every one of his clients was a single older woman with no family. So he knew exactly the type of person he was looking for. He knew what their asset base was because he'd done their taxes for a few years. Mm-hmm. And then he proceeded to, again, prepare false tax returns with all kinds of, refunds that were due. And he had the refunds come to him. And over time, he again took millions of dollars from highly vulnerable individuals, male and female, and, was able to manipulate because he also became joint on their bank accounts. They trusted him with their entire financial life. And eventually he was caught. Some of them had passed on at the time, and others were left with virtually nothing.
That's really terrible. And you were saying last time when you were in this show, even when the fraud becomes evident and you go, oh my God, like this guy now owns my house or he's clearing out my bank account, that there's often very little you can do to get it back.
Yeah. And it depends, again, there's the circumstances are individual for every case. But yes, there's often very little you can do to actually get it back. And in cases like this, where he spent the money, although in this case, we executed search warrants in three different jurisdictions at the same time, it was a busy morning because we learned that he had purchased a house, he had cars, he had all sorts of other assets. So we were able to forfeit many of those assets and return them to the estate of many of the people that he had taken care of and others. But it was we weren't able to get to everybody. Mm-hmm. But another example that it's again a trusted party, and this has come up several times. I've had several cases where we've gone against ministers of various denominations who have encouraged members of their congregations to give him particular amounts of money on the side. So this would not look like you were giving a donation to the church, but you were giving a donation to a particular individual because he was starting up some kind of business who was then going to be lucrative and give it back to you. These all ended up being in some variation of a Ponzi scheme in which people lost a lot of money. But the fact that it's coming from one of the most trusted type of people in your life makes you more susceptible to wanting to participate, to joining a group of people with whom you practiced a particular religion and met on a regular basis for those purposes. Mm-hmm. And again, faced some financial devastation at the end of that.
Those are just terrible stories, and you hear about them and you hope that this is like a very rare and extreme case with someone who's really kind of, really off their center. But what I'm hearing is that this happens more frequently than we would like to believe.
Right. And it's because it's often not reported, because people don't report because they're embarrassed.
Right.
Because they are filled with shame, that they feel like they should have known better and all of those things. And I think those are all true. But the thing to always remember in all of these cases is the people that are looking at you, either family members or close friends or associates that you work with all the time. They're looking for people who are feeling lonely, loneliness, and socially isolated, maybe from other family members. Like, for example, with the grandmother and the grandson, maybe she was alienated from her other grandchildren. Maybe he was the only one who paid attention to her, so she paid attention to him, when in fact that wasn't he did not have the same heart that she did, let's just say.
Right. He didn't have her best interest at heart.
No, only his own. So, I mean, I think that these things also, morph into different ways. Another case that I had, which was similar, again, playing on the idea of loneliness and social isolation, there was a hairdresser, and Luigi specialized in doing the ladies, the older, wonderful ladies, as he would say. And he had all these women that he did their hair, who had already owned some piece of real estate. And he would have dinners at his house for these special 8 or 9 women. And he would make Italian food, and it would just go on and on and on. Well, he eventually became the owner of all of their condominiums. He moved all of their financial information to him. He became a joint owner on their bank accounts. And he became an heir in their wills in many cases. But wow. The keys of having the ownership of the real estate, the condominiums and the bank accounts, he had something well over $10 million in fraud. By the time we caught up with him, he had already fled the country and we couldn't find him. It was very disturbing to me. And all these women lost, I cannot tell you everything. But there's a couple of lessons there. One, and we'll go on to how to protect yourself. But one of the keys is to make sure you know who's on. If you have a joint account with anybody, make sure it's somebody that you trust. Because a joint account is not a 50-50 account. It's 100-100. So if you have a joint account with someone, you're entitled to everything that's in that account. And the person with whom you have it is also entitled to 100% of what's in that account. People misunderstand that term sometimes, and joint accounts are not always the best thing for older individuals. So
yeah, these are just horror stories, and some of them sound spectacular or extreme, and it does definitely make the case. But I'm wondering, how common is this? And I know we don't really know, because like you said, a lot of people get embarrassed and they either don't know who to report it to, or they're too ashamed about what happened, or they're kind of at their wits. They're too scared to think straight because they're just facing that all their life savings and their home has been taken by someone they thought they could trust. So, but how widespread is this kind of fraud?
This is somewhere, almost close to 80% of elder fraud comes through friends and family. And so if you were to take, let's say, my conservative $30 billion number, let's just take, 80% of that. And that would be about the numbers. But the numbers of people reporting are very low. Mm-hmm. For example, for the best research that we have shows us that only 1 in 44 cases of financial exploitation is ever reported. So only 1 in 44. So we know that is, it's hardly ever reported, although we are encouraging people to do so. So still, the best thing to do is, if you know this has happened to you, is to file a police report, because at least we have some indication that this has happened. The police then can go forward and do an investigation. It may end up as, with an arrest. It may not, but you may be able to find assets you didn't know were taken from you. There's all kinds of things that can come out of that. Once you're in the system, there are all victim advocates that can help you find housing, can help you, provide social services if you need them after this particular kind of economic devastation. There's all kinds of things that can come from that report, and also to Adult Protective Services if that has also occurred in circumstances. So, reporting is key for lots of reasons. It tells us how big the problem is, but it also tells that it gives the individual somewhere to go to begin the process of getting your life back after
healing and recovery.
Yeah. 100%.
So I'm wondering now, because I have a live case of a friend who has someone that he trusts that has, my friend has sent him substantial money for this bond. And he's expecting big money back from this bond. First of all, bonds don't usually return big money, but second of all, and you had advised us to go to this website to check it out, which I did. And they say, anytime anyone guarantees you a big return, run the other way, because nothing is ever guaranteed. No legitimate investment would ever give you a guarantee. But what do I do? Like, my friend is so convinced this is real. He's actually planning what to do with the money. He wants to do all these great things for people around the world with these funds he's going to get. But I'm like, how do I talk to him in such a way that he listens, that this person he thinks is so trustworthy is actually probably a scam artist?
Yeah, I mean, this is the most difficult thing of all, because some people, you know, because it involves a huge psychological issue that is interwoven with the monetary issues. Mm-hmm. And it also it depends on where the person is in the aging process and the change in the aging brain. I mean, there's a lot of things that come into play here. But, you know, you might email the SEC. Maybe somebody will talk to him, because it's this particular scheme you mentioned is extremely common. There's the jumbo bond. It's going to return all this money. Blah, blah. You better believe it's just a different type of Ponzi scheme, basically. It is. I mean, at least the ones I've looked at and I've prosecuted are exactly that. But there's all these promises, and the returns on the bond are always going to be greater than any possible return at the stock market. So if the average return on the stock market over a long period of time is 7%, that's, I think, the average number, then you can look at this, and I'm sure this bond is going to pay 10, 15, 20% once it comes in. But it's, of course, never going to come in, because he needs more money to get more people to get into the bond business. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. I don't know. Maybe if somebody else can explain it to him and it's not you because you're his friend, that might be helpful. I mean, I don't know, because people react to different people in so many different ways, but that's a very classic scheme.
Yeah. Tell us that website to go to, because I'm thinking maybe if I send him to this website, he can look at it and go, oh my God, you're like, check, check, check. This is what this fraudster is doing to me.
That's from the Securities and Exchange Commission, and it's called investor.gov, G-O-V.
Investor.gov. And it lays out, it says, here's the ways people will try to get money from you. And they list it out. And I went, he's got two of them, bonds and currency exchanges.
Oh, currency for sure. Yep. Big, very big.
Really?
Yep. Very big. So both of those are things to be wary of.
Yeah. They're like yellow flags coming up.
Right. And the bond thing will become very popular when the stock market isn't as spectacularly successful as it is right now. That always comes back. These same schemes return over and over again as the market forces change. Mm-hmm. So it's a little surprising to me that the bond is out there now.
Well, he's been doing it, I think, for years.
Yeah. Oh, no. I'm sure. I'm sure. I have no doubt about that. But anyway, so maybe we can talk a little bit, if you don't mind, Eleanor, about some of the ways to protect yourself.
Let our listeners know, like, it seems obvious, protect yourself by not trusting someone. But, you know, I'm sure you've got a lot of real specific advice for our listeners on, even if you think you can trust someone, there's certain things you can do to protect yourself.
Right. And there's things you can put in place that are not going to be offensive to your family members. They're not going to be anything that would bother any other people that you might deal with in your regular life, but they would protect yourself to be able to give, to make sure that your assets go where you want them to go. I am always reminded when I start to talk about this, about a woman I met in Memphis many years ago. We were meeting with a group of about 50 people who were senior companions in a Memphis development. And we started to talk about financial exploitation, and she raised her hand. She was so fun. She goes, I just want you to know, I have 6 children. I love every one of them, but I only trust 3 of them. So I always think we always know, whether we want to admit it or not, who we trust. And so she was talking about the way she set up her will for those 3 children to make sure they took care of the other 3 children and everything was equal, but she didn't trust 6 to be involved. So I thought, there you go. That sort of sums it up there. So what are the kinds of documents you need to protect yourself? One is a financial power of attorney. There are different kinds. So you should make sure you get the kind that you want. Use the most it's called a durable power of attorney. That's good for all kinds of different kinds of accounts. But you want to make sure that whoever you appoint to be your power of attorney is a person who will conduct business in the way that you would and for your benefit. A medical power of attorney does the same thing. Those are two key documents, and they're different documents. So those are two things. The other is you should have a will, no matter, I don't care if you have 5 cents or $5 million, it doesn't make any difference. You need to have a will, unless you want your assets to go to your next of kin, and that isn't always the way people want to have things done.
Right. And just on that financial power of attorney, as I would say, if anybody is asking you to give them financial power of attorney, like instant yellow flag, like, why are they asking me?
Sirens, you know.
Right. Just like, no, that means they could have access to all your money.
That means they might be interested in doing it too.
They might be interested. Yes.
On the other hand, I think that there are conversations that families need to have around these issues, which would incorporate the question of, well, mom or dad or whoever, Aunt Tilly, whoever you are, maybe you should give the power of attorney to somebody to be able to do these in case you can't. I mean, there's lots of ways to have that conversation. And I would recommend to all of your listeners something called the conversationproject.org. The Conversation Project started many years ago around this issue of how do families have difficult conversations about end of life. And what they realized, it wasn't just end of life. It was really about what are the documents look like? What are the things that we need to have in place as a family to be able to take care of this person as the person gets older? What they've learned is the older person is often ready to go on this, and it's the family that doesn't want to think about that older person dying, so they don't have these discussions. So, but
right. And I would say, you know, given the rise in dementia now, it's not just dying. That the odds are pretty high as you get older and older you have some impairment of judgment.
Correct.
And you may need someone who you can trust that would carry out your financial affairs.
Yeah, absolutely correct. But the Conversation Project will give you good ways of having that conversation and about talking about things like powers of attorney. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend that to all of you too. But, definitely have a will. The other thing is make sure if you have anything like an insurance policy that your beneficiaries are up to date. Mm-hmm. You have the right people on there. There was a point in time where I helped my parents update their wills. And I hadn't seen their wills, so I didn't know what I was updating. And I took a look and I was like, holy tomatoes, this is not what they want. I know that. So we went back and we changed some of the people that they had made specific requests to, mm-hmm. and made sure that they were much more in line with the people that they wanted to benefit later. Mm-hmm. And it's very important to do that every few years. It doesn't have to be every year, but I don't know, every 5 or 10 years, as circumstances change, you might want to just take a look and see what your documents look like. Make sure that information is up to date. Make sure that insurance policy is actually going to benefit person you want it to benefit. You can change this stuff anytime you want to. So please don't feel locked into it. I was giving a speech at an AARP group of older adults, and one woman who had a joint account with someone said, I don't want my niece to have access to my account anymore, but I don't know what to do about it. I mean, I put her down as my joint account and all that. And I said, I'll tell you what to do. Walk into the bank and tell them you want to change your account. That you have the power to do that. But she somehow felt that once she had made that decision, that it was irrevocable and she couldn't change it. And she needed to go back and she didn't know what to do. Just telling her that she had the power, because she had all of her benefits, her Social Security benefits and others directly deposited into that account. That's the only money that went in there was hers. And her niece was spending it. So she wanted to change that. And I said, just go to the bank and close that one account and start another account. And that's how you do it.
Wow.
And it seems that now that's a very simple thing to discuss. But I think that if you have a joint account and you're not feeling too comfortable with the other person on the account, or it's a place where you have your benefits directly deposited, which is, again, another thing you should do. It's really important to make sure that financial arrangement is exactly the kind of way that you want it to go to put together.
Yeah. And, you know, being aware, like you say, this direct deposit of benefits, I would think for a lot of older people, you're talking a direct deposit of a Social Security check.
Correct.
Every month. You want that going into your bank account not into, you know, not allow somebody else to divert it to their bank account.
Or you don't want it to go into a joint account and have the person who with whom you share the account take the money out, which is right. often what the case is. And that's a thing you want to really guard against, because that's another form of exploitation. You know, this is just, you know, takings. So the other thing that's really important is a nurse. She never made very much money, but she loved to open accounts. And just before she, about 3 or 4 months before she passed away, I started on a campaign to find all of the accounts and to put them together. I mean, some had a couple $100, some had 150. They all had very, very low balances, but there must have been 8 or 9 of them, all in different financial institutions. So as I located them, I consolidated them into one larger account so that I didn't have to find all of these accounts later. It was also better from a financial standpoint. But often you'll find with some family members and maybe yourself, you've opened a bunch of different accounts for whatever reasons. Over time, it's much better and easier to manage your finances if you have them consolidated. That's true of credit cards too. I'll use my mother as an example. Of course, she was in her 90s when this happened, so there's a lot of cognition issues as well. But mm-hmm. I remember going into a dress shop with her of a well-known chain. I was in the dressing room trying something on, and in those few minutes, the cashier at the store had gotten my mother to fill out an application for a credit card.
With her social security number on it.
Social security number and her address and everything else that she needs. And I just took the application and I ripped it up and I said, nobody asked for this card. We don't need it. Thank you very much. But I think that, and again, a way to protect yourself from all of this exploitation, especially from friends and family, is to consolidate all of those credit cards. If you have lots of department store cards or whatever, you don't really need them. I don't think they do anything to enhance much except your ease of purchasing. And you can do that with a major credit card. And I eventually got her down to one credit card and my father to one credit card. But that was a way to protect them, really, because I could see if anything was happening on any of those cards, I was able to see that right away. So it was
It's easier to monitor one than 20.
Right, exactly. So, and the other thing to always make sure that you have organized in a way that's good for you to know and understand is all of your retirement accounts. Accounts can be a 401k. They could be in a defined benefit plan where you get regular payments. Make sure that those would go into your bank account as a direct. Make sure that if you have any annuities, that those are also directly deposited into your bank account so that you can see what your financial picture looks like. So if someone is beginning to steal from you, for example, you can see that right away, or someone else who you've asked to take a look at your financial picture can see that there has been some sort of, you know, withdrawal on a regular basis or some sort of, you know, additional charge that you never signed up for. Right now I'm fighting with Amazon because for whatever reasons I bought an Amazon Prime membership to purchase something for my church, and I could only do it through that system. So they have now got other credit card numbers from me, and they are charging every single credit card the same Amazon Prime monthly fee. So trying to get, which is an exploitation by, you know, by a commercial vendor. But it's the kind of thing where that by friends and family to have a particular charge on a regular basis for a particular service that you may or may not have. So I'm undoing all of that now. But it's the kind of thing you want to take a look at and make sure that you protect yourself from that. The other thing is,
they pick the wrong person to overcharge that. I mean, that could be a class action suit. If they're doing it to you, how many other people?
I'm sure. And it was shocking because it showed, and I'll tell you how I found it. It showed up on my father's credit card. My father passed away in November. I never used that credit card. And that's how I was like, wow, what, Amazon Prime? He's not buying anything. I know that. And I don't use that credit card. Was his, you know, to use, not anybody, his and mine. I never used it except for him. But anyway. Well,
and that's a reminder to all of us to look at our credit card. We get statements every month.
Yeah.
Look at them and just see, did I actually make all these charges? Are they legitimate? I got one from Discover the other day, called me on a fraud alert. There was a $5 charge for Google something or other, but it was, they had done it 8 times in one day. It was like, how stupid are these guys? If they had done it 3 or 4 times, they might have gotten away with it. But they did, you know, they triggered the fraud alert and I had to cancel the credit card and do the whole thing. But the other thing that I've found helpful is this idea of monitoring your assets on a monthly basis. I've put out this spreadsheet. Now, not everybody loves spreadsheets the way I have come to love spreadsheets, but I have all my assets down. And every month I go, this is what I have in these various accounts. So if there's any variation that looks out of whack, I'll catch it. If I haven't caught it during the 30 days, that's when I'm going to catch it.
Well, but you remind me also of two other good things, which are also protective devices. One is if you have someone that you're caring for, or an older adult in your family, or that you want to care for in a financial way, you can often get duplicate statements sent to you, but you don't have transactional authority. There are ways within both financial services in the banks and in brokerage accounts where you can get a view only so that you can see that person's account and see if there's any kind of nefarious activity going on. So those are two very common and often used ways of monitoring to make sure that that older person primarily isn't being exploited in any way. Another recommendation that I would like to make to everyone is a company called EverSafe. It's EverSafe.com. EverSafe was founded by a gentleman whose mother was financially exploited. She was a Juilliard graduate. She was a CPA, and someone found a way through her accounts, primarily through her computer. But his point was, here's a good, smart woman who was paying for some sort of automotive insurance when she no longer had a car. So, and then from there, other things were, you know, because other financial information was then revealed. But EverSafe is a system which they have the capacity to take all of your financial information and send you alerts when anything happens in anything. There's a credit card interest change. There's a fraudulent looking charge on a credit card. There is some sort of payment that looks out of whack. There is something, anything that happens. They have, I think, a series of over 40 different types of alerts that will pop up on your phone. And you can, a lot of the larger brokerage firms are giving this service to their clients with significant assets. But I'm telling, most of the people that they have are middle income people who don't want to lose anything. And they have a sliding scale of month. So it isn't the same fee for everybody, but it is the number one best way to track anything having to do with any of your assets. So I recommend that to everyone as well. The other thing to think about is real estate. If you own any real estate, make sure that that real estate is included in your will, or or you have a beneficiary of that real estate in a way that you know you want that condominium or that apartment or whatever it is, that your piece of land, you know, like my Uncle Russell, this piece of land had been in his family, gosh, since right after the Civil War. It was this little piece of land in Virginia that, you know, was given to his family had been enslaved. And this was their free piece of land. It was such an important piece. But everybody has something like that that they care about. It could be in real estate or something else. But if you have any real estate, make sure that you know that the deeds are up to date, that everything has been done, the taxes have been paid. And make sure that will you know, will be able to be part of your estate and go to the, to those who you wish to have it. So those are some of the, those are some of the things that I would definitely do to protect yourself. And I think if you do most of those, make sure your joint accounts are with people that you trust, make sure you have direct deposits, make sure you've consolidated your financial accounts. Also limit the number of credit cards you have. You can also, if you wanted to, there are some debit cards available that limit you to only going to certain locations, to certain stores for certain amounts of money. So that you, again, limit your liability. When I was taking care of my father's accounts, for example, I made sure that his bank account had a very low balance. Mm-hmm. Just in case anybody was able to get any of his information and be able to go into that particular account, they would be disappointed with the dollars. And I did that quite deliberately. But I think that, you know, sometimes there are opportunities where there may be a large amount that would go into a bank account. You don't necessarily want to do that. So,
right. Because if you've got a large amount of money sitting in a bank account, it's like a crime magnet.
It is a crime magnet. That's a good example. A crime magnet. Good. Yeah. Good.
People who want money, we're going to go after the big enchiladas if they can get it.
Right. And when you put all these little pieces in place, what you've done is you've created barriers to the withdrawal of that money. And as I said before, and I'll say again a million times, time is the enemy of the thief. If you slow this process down, the thief will probably go somewhere else where access is much easier. And that thief can be family member, it can be your lawyer, your banker, your accountant, somebody who you have in your regular life, just as much as a third party. So,
those are all great ideas. And I think one of the things to keep in mind, even you say, like, if you're going to put someone in your will or power of attorney or even on your bank account or any of those things, you have to have it be someone you trust. But be aware, even if you trust them, something could go awry. So I think that philosophy of trust but verify is good.
That right. Trust but, yep.
If you give someone a credit card to go do your shopping, which, by the way, we do with my daughter, and because she does our grocery shopping for, she loves to shop. So I hate to shop. So she does the shopping, but I just check and I look at the monthly statement. You know, is everything in order? And it is. And so that's good, but trust, but verify.
And if somewhere along the line, you are uncomfortable and there's something that's telling you inside of you that this is not the best arrangement for you, you can change that. And you should always remember you have the power to do that. I will never forget this woman. When I was talking at the senior center, and she wasn't the only one who felt trapped in mm-hmm. her decision of having a certain person on her joint bank account, and just the knowledge that she had the power within her to change it was just eye-opening to me. And I think we all have to keep in mind that what we might decide one day is not necessarily forever if we need to change it. But we also have to be aware of people who want to induce us to change it for their own benefit. So I think you have to sort of keep your eyes open and keep your radar up. I think under those particular circumstances, because these are all relationships of trust. They are relationships of love. And it's difficult for us to face the fact that someone that we love or someone that we trust would do something to harm us. And I think that's the most difficult thing to come to terms with. But when you are feeling lonely and you're feeling isolated and you have nowhere to turn, you may be vulnerable to these types of events. So,
right. I think that's excellent advice. I was actually fortunate growing up. My father was a police officer. So, you know, if you're a police officer, it's kind of like you. I mean, the daily work you're doing is looking at the people who are doing bad things.
Right.
And so he raised me to be skeptical and to be very careful, particularly around money. He never trusted banks. I mean, he went a little too far. Right. But But in hindsight, he wasn't. Now that I see what all the banks have been doing, sometimes you can't trust the banks.
Yeah.
what they're doing, like Wells Fargo, doing these accounts with people. So you have to be really careful with that. But just make sure it's like taking charge of your own life and taking charge of your own money. And I know particularly a lot of women kind of rely on someone else. They might rely at first on their father, then they rely on a husband, then the husband may pass away. They may be kind of trained to rely on someone. It was like, no, you know, take command of your own finances and learn how things work, learn to monitor it.
Right.
And you'll be more protected. You'll have more of your money for more of your life to have a higher quality life while you're here.
And less anxiety about it, you know, which is really, it's a huge piece. And the other thing is just take one step at a time. You don't have to do it all at once. Just take one step at a time, but make sure that you do it. And if it's changed the, you know, the beneficiaries, make sure they're up to date. Just do one or two things at a time so it's not so overwhelming.
So what would be some of those steps? Like say there's someone listening here and they're thinking as they're listening, you know, I really am not on top of my own. And I've talked to friends who are like very big on women's empowerment, leaders in the women's movement, professors, and they have no idea about their money. They've right. like turned it over to somebody else. I'm like, I'm horrified. So
yes,
What would be the some simple steps that these people can take?
Well, I think that, and they, it's much of the list I just said. Make sure you have an active power of attorney for your financial stuff. Make a list of all of your assets, just a list.
Mm-hmm.
What bank accounts do you have? What credit cards do you have? What real estate do you have? What investments do you have? Everything that you can possibly think of. Just make a list. And then you will know what that power of attorney would have available to that person. So get a financial power of attorney, get a will, get, and if you, in, for sometimes people want to set up a trust. So because they don't let their money to go to their children, but they want it to go to their grandchildren. There's ways to, and get a medical power of attorney, because if something happens to you and you are unable to do any of the things you want to do, or there needs to be some decision, you also need to have that power of attorney for financial stuff work with the medical power of attorney to make sure that they have the outcome that you want. So you have to have conversations about what your desire is, how you would spend your money and what you would like. Make sure you have beneficiaries up to date and make sure that you have your direct deposit as much as you want. But the most important thing is to make a list of your assets.
Yeah, make a list of your assets.
Make a list. What do you want? What on earth do I have?
Right. And also monitor your assets.
Oh, yeah. Watch. Look at everything.
Look at everything.
Because it's really
critical. Right.
Yep.
So
yep.
Check those monthly bank statements. Check those monthly credit card statements.
Exactly. Check all of that stuff. But I would make that list of assets and have a power of attorney, a financial one and a medical one, and make sure you have a will. Otherwise, there are laws that are going to dictate where your estate goes. That may not be what you want. And if you want it, so you have to make sure that it's going to go where you want it to go. But if you have those other things, that will set up a big barrier toward exploitation. And don't give stuff to people that you love just because they're asking for it. Think about whether or not you want that money to go there. For example, my father always gave money for education because it mattered to him. It was his ticket out of poverty. So that mattered to him. Other things, not so much.
Well, that's great. Well, I encourage you to write a book because I want to read it. That's all the time we have. Judith Kozlowski, thank you so much for being with us today and for helping people to keep their money away from the fraudsters.
Thank you very much, Eleanor, for having me. I much appreciate it.